Voice of Minnesota, it's FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Friday afternoon. Two interviews lined up for you on the show today that are going to take up, well, most of our content time. One of them is going to be with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Man, it seems like we do these interviews every couple of weeks, but we need to because we have yet another threat to Social Security. This one comes courtesy to us of Dean Phillips, of all people, our Democratic representative in the 3rd Congressional District, not someone you would really expect to be on board with possibly cutting Social Security. So what this essentially does, he signed a letter along with several other Democratic and Republican representatives in support of what's called the Trust Act. Now, the Trust Act is something that's sponsored by Mitt Romney in the Senate, which should tell you kind of all you need to know. And basically, it fast-tracks cuts to Social Security without going through the proper legislative process. And as you can probably guess, that gives politicians cover to cut Social Security without as much public scrutiny. So we're going to be talking with Max in just a little bit about that and talk about why so many Democrats, including our own Dean Phillips, are on board with this really, really horrible legislation. Also ahead, we're going to be talking about the effort to get Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman recalled. A citizen group has put together a campaign to get Mike Freeman recalled, and it requires your signature to do so. We're going to be speaking with one of the organizers about the reasons why they think Mike Freeman needs to be removed from office. And among them is just going back to the original criminal complaint that was filed with those third-degree murder charges against Derek Chauvin. Now, again, those charges were eventually upgraded to level 2 once Keith Ellison took over the case. But if you read through the criminal complaint, and not just through the news releases, for the most part, when you read through this, it almost sounds like a criminal defense of Derek Chauvin. There is tons of irrelevant information put in this criminal complaint explaining how somehow George Floyd was resisting arrest and had pre-existing medical conditions. Just stuff that is irrelevant whatsoever to the fact that Derek Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd's neck for over 8 minutes long. Yet somehow this made this in the prosecution's criminal complaint. The prosecution is supposed to be trying to get Derek Chauvin convicted, not try to defend him. So I encourage you to check that out. It is over at the website of Recalling Mike Freeman. The website is recallfreeman.org. As you can read through that entire criminal complaint and the notes that this group made on the criminal complaint explaining how Mike Freeman really didn't exercise his duty properly. So tell you what, we're going to take a break and come on back with one of the group's organizers, Anthony Hernandez, as we're going to go into much more detail about the recall effort. That's on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Friday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So, over the past few weeks, we've seen an effort to recall Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman in light of the controversy he's been in regards to the murder charges against Derek Chauvin. And one of the organizers of the Recall Mike Freeman campaign is Anthony Hernandez, who joins us now on the program. Hey, Anthony, how are you doing today?
Hey, Brett. I am doing well. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so tell me what sparked this recall effort. Mike Freeman obviously has had a very close relationship with law enforcement, but can you expand a little bit more on that?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's important for us to remember that Mike Freeman was in charge of this case for 6 days before the governor had to step in. And even though Attorney General Ellison is now handling the case, even in that short amount of time, even in those 6 days, Mike Freeman made several mistakes that made it significantly harder to hold Derek Chauvin accountable and made it significantly harder to bring justice to George Floyd and his family. So some specific things that he did. He failed to recuse himself from this case, despite working so intimately with the MPD and many other aspects of his office. He didn't recuse himself. That's kind of a problem across elected prosecutors. He should have done that in this case. The second thing he did, he made some statements to the press at the first press conference on May 28th, where he basically implied that there was evidence that suggested that Derek Chauvin didn't commit a criminal act. Prosecutors have an ethical obligation to not prejudice a trial, and by saying that in front of thousands of Minnesotans who are watching, he did prejudice a trial. And then also, I would encourage folks to go to our website, recallfreeman.org, where we actually took the initial charging document when Freeman charged third degree before it was upcharged to second degree by Ellison. We actually took Freeman's initial charging document and annotated it and showed all the ways that Freeman was actually kind of sounding more like a defense attorney for Chauvin rather than a prosecutor trying to win a case. So, you know, we've lost trust in him. I would argue the governor was actually the first vote of no confidence when he took the case away from Freeman. And now we're out there across Hennepin County gathering 526 signatures to take Freeman out of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
Yeah, and I had a chance to go through and read through those charges that you were bringing up, including the original criminal complaint, and it is unbelievable to read through this thing. I mean, it's basically character assassination and almost a defense of Derek Chauvin, as you bring up how they cite that original autopsy showing that, his death was basically caused by having underlying medical conditions. There's lots of other things to highlight on there, including a report that he was resisting arrest George Floyd, which obviously isn't true. So it is really unreal to read through this thing, because you can listen to all of the news reports or read the news reports, but if you go back and read the original criminal charges, it does very much sound like a defense of Chauvin.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, securing a conviction against a cop is always difficult. And even in those that short amount of time that Mike Freeman was responsible for this, he made it significantly harder to bring justice. And so, you know, this is, of course, on top of, you know, two decades plus of Freeman doing harm to communities of color, not leading on issues of criminal justice reform. And I think people are really hungry for action that they can take. And, you know, elected prosecutors up until about 10 years ago, elected prosecutors kind of flew under the radar, even though they're kind of arguably the most powerful person in local justice systems. But within the past 10 years, we've seen progressive prosecutors become elected. We've seen a level of scrutiny that they've never had to deal with before. And so what we're spending, you know, not only are we 100% intent on actually going through all the steps to actually get to a removal election for Freeman, but we're also sending a message to elected prosecutors in Minnesota and around the country that people are paying attention, and, you know, what was able to fly in the past won't fly anymore.
So talk a little bit about the defense we sometimes hear about the actions of Mike Freeman. This is at least what I remember, I think, his office saying, but it's very tough to convict a police officer. Therefore, we went with murder 3 and second degree manslaughter originally, rather than charging him with something higher. That would be a second degree or first degree murder charge. Can you respond to that defense?
You know, we do have volunteer attorneys on our team. I'm not an attorney yet myself, but I do think, you know, we have heard Freeman say that. And I think that, you know, whether or not I could let others respond to that particular argument, but I can just speak to personally. I remember watching that press conference live on May 28th. And when it became clear that he was not going to make an arrest, that he was not going to announce charges, that really felt like a different type of dereliction of duty, because this city was on edge so much. And he kind of just punted the ball and said, we're not ready yet, which is, you know, I've spoken to a lot of public defenders and attorneys, and, you know, they'll make the point, and maybe you've heard this too, if Derek Chauvin had been anyone else, if video evidence had been found for a citizen doing that to a different citizen that wasn't a police officer, that person would have been arrested immediately. You can adjust the charges after an arrest. And so I think, you know, that's just a failure of leadership to not really realize that the situation that our state and our city and our country was in demanded you to do something that showed leadership.
Yeah, and going back to what you're saying, obviously all you got to do is go out and watch the video, and you can see there's pretty clear evidence that there should be, at the very least, a murder two conviction, which, of course, what the charges were eventually upgraded to. And even going back to your point, talking about how, yeah, at that press conference, he was saying that maybe there's some evidence that doesn't support a conviction. Well, if there actually is evidence that doesn't support a conviction, show us that evidence, because...
Right.
Very uncomfortable when he goes and then walks back that statement, because if he's walking that back, then why even originally say that in the first place?
Right. And I think, and you know, one thing that I've been saying to people recently is, you know, the consensus was so clear and so quick that he couldn't handle this case. And that's extraordinary to an extent that, you know, there was really no pushback from taking this case away from him. And, you know, the governor said, in a sense, no confidence. And, you know, that was ever since then, that's kind of the spark that we've been fueling ourselves with. You know, it's kind of it's fueled by two things. It's both Freeman's mishandling of this case specifically, but then also, you know, people are signing for kind of a whole host of other reasons, going back to how he's handled sexual assault cases in his office, you know, charging people with felonies for buying $10 of marijuana and police stings, which was reported in 2018. You know, there's kind of a longstanding history and this very clear moment that we think deserves a recall. And, you know, we will admit it, a recall is a big step.
Let's break that down. What does a recall effort look for someone like Mike Freeman, who is a county attorney?
Totally. So, yeah, I can speak to the process a little bit, and then I can share our thinking around the process. So that number I mentioned, 126,522, that's the number of signatures that we need to gather. And that number comes from, you have to look at the prior county attorney election, so 2018, and you have to get 25% of that total from 2018. So 126,000 is 25% of all the votes cast in 2018 for this office. They have to be in person signatures, and they have to be signatures of Hennepin County registered voters. So that's the first step. That's what we're doing right now, collecting the signatures. Second is the signatures go to Hennepin County Elections for approval and review. Third, this would go to the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now that might, you might remember earlier this week, we saw the Chief Justice throw out a recall case against the governor. There's actually two separate processes for recalling state officials versus county officials. So for a county recall, we actually get the signatures first, then it goes to the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. She decides if the case has merit. Freeman is entitled to a public hearing. He may or may not choose that. And then there last step of this all would be, there'd actually be a removal election. So it'd be like a referendum, yes, no, do you wish to recall him? So a lot of steps.
Yeah.
You know, this is definitely a marathon. And, you know, I think, we announced this week that we've officially surpassed 10,000 signatures, which, you know, that's not just 10,000 online signatures. This is 10,000 in-person Hennepin County registered voter signatures that we've gathered. And that's been with, you know, not accepting any donations yet. That's just been a group of us as volunteers kind of organizing, gathering, speaking to people. And, you know, once we talk with folks, whether or not they know Freeman or not, it's a very easy sales pitch, because, you know, whether or not they've known of the harm that he's done for decades, or they just know of him, you know, in the past month, people are ready to sign.
Yeah, and I highly recommend people go to recallfreeman.org and read the original criminal complaint that was filed, because as we alluded to earlier, it's just unbelievable with the amount of character assassination and kind of defense we're seeing of Derek Chauvin. So we are in some of the first steps of the recall effort against Mike Freeman. As you said, right now you're trying to gather signatures, and of course those have to be in-person signatures. Those cannot be done electronically. Can you talk about how people can go about doing that, and I think also importantly, who is eligible to sign?
Absolutely. So we would really encourage anyone who thinks Mike Freeman needs to go, anyone who's interested in this, to go to recallfreeman.org. Follow us on our social media pages. It's Recall Freeman on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And on all of those accounts, we update our daily locations. So we've had basically a permanent presence at 38th and Chicago, at the site of the George Floyd Memorial. So we've been there pretty consistently since June 3rd. And then we're also kind of doing different locations around the metro. So we've had in Northeast this week, we're having one on the north side. We've had organizers go to more community events in the suburbs. So it's always changing, which is good, so we can reach other folks. But it also means I'd really encourage people to go and see where the locations are for that day. And then as far as who can do it, you don't need an ID. You just need to be a registered voter who lives in Hennepin County. And I think, you know, Hennepin County is a big, as you know, is a huge county. It's not just Minneapolis. It's basically Minneapolis and all of the western suburbs. So if you are in Richfield, Bloomington, Eden Prairie, Edina, St. Louis Park, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, and more, you know, you can sign this petition. You need to be a registered voter. You can check that really easily on the Minnesota Secretary of State website and live in the county and sign in person. And we've been taking precautions with COVID. We have drive-through locations. Folks can stay in their cars. We ask people to bring their own pen, to wear a mask. Our volunteers are masked and gloved. So we're kind of, you know, given obviously social distancing, we're doing all that we can.
So what's the time window that you have to collect all of these signatures?
Yeah, so, you know, for state recalls, this is not a state recall. State recalls have a 90-day window to gather their signatures. For this county-level recall, we actually don't have that same type of time limit. We just need to get this done at least 6 months before the next election. Mm-hmm. So the next time this office is up is 2022. So, we have, again, it's a marathon. We've collected 10,000 in our first 2 weeks, and we're looking to expand. So, you know, this is going to be a month-long process. We haven't set an end date yet. You can perhaps expect that soon, but we really are, you know, slow and steady. The momentum's building. And one of the exciting things is that we've been bringing in, you know, volunteers to help run our collection sites. They volunteer for one shift, they volunteer for a second shift, and all of a sudden they're leading their own collection site, or they're signing up to go knock and canvass their own neighborhood. And that's really how we're going to get scale on this. Because, you know, we were thrilled about 10,000. That's still about 8% of, you know, what we need. So it's a marathon. It's going to take many months, but the more folks can sign, the more folks can donate or volunteer, that's how we're going to get there.
A couple more final questions for you here, Anthony.
Yeah.
What types of stories have you been hearing from folks as they've been signing this recall effort? Have they been sharing stories about how they've been harassed by the police, or maybe stories about how they've had negative interactions with law enforcement, or just overall have not been happy with how the county attorney has been handling these types of police cases?
Yeah, you know, I think thank you for asking that question. We actually have been, when folks go to our website, they'll see a tab that's called Share Your Story. So we're actually compiling something that we're calling a people's history of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, where folks can submit their stories, just to kind of, that we could potentially read, that we can use, that we can amplify this message with. And you're absolutely right. I think the damage that Mike Freeman has done runs a spectrum, right? From these high profile cases like George Floyd or Jamar Clark. Those obviously take up so much media attention. But then if you go back the 20 plus years that he's been there, it's not just, you know, police killings. It's also, you know, survivors of sexual assault who felt belittled by his office. It's also someone who was held in jail for cash bail because they didn't have enough to pay, that missed the job, missed going home for dinner, and has that on their record. You know, it's a whole host of individual stories that, you know, from the exurbs to the suburbs to Minneapolis, and, you know, every type of person, you would find represented in these stories. And so I think as those stories have started to come in, it's been really powerful. And I think that, that's how we're going to win. And what's going to propel us to 126,000 is, yes, George Floyd, how he handled this case is grounds enough for him to be recalled. But there's also six terms of harm that's going to get people motivated as well.
And again, check out that website, recallfreeman.org. That's recallfreeman.org. We've been speaking with Anthony Hernandez, one of the organizers with the effort to recall Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. Really appreciate the time, Anthony, today, and encourage people to, again, check out that website.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brett. And I hope lots of your listeners will come engage and come along with us.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking about this bill that has bipartisan support in Congress that could lead to some pretty dramatic cuts to Social Security. And by the way, this bill has the support of our own 3rd District Representative Dean Phillips. We're going to be chatting with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare about this bill up next on FYI Politics. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So joining us now on the show is Max Richman, friend of the show. He's with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, as we are going to be talking about yet another proposal which could lead to benefit cuts for Social Security. And this one is significant since it actually has the support of our own Democratic Representative Dean Phillips here in the 3rd District of Minnesota. So we need to dive into this legislation called the Trust Act. So, Max, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Now, thank you for having me, Brett.
So, in your own words, can you tell me a little bit about what the Trust Act is and what it would do? I know there's these rescue committees with this Trust Act, and anytime I hear rescue committee and legislation, that normally isn't a good thing.
Yeah, that gives you pause, as it does many of us. The legislation in the House, it's H.R. 4907, the Trust Act. There's a companion in the Senate, S-2733. And what the legislation does is it provides a fast-track vehicle, in effect, would push through reforms, I say that in quotes, of Social Security and other trust funds, and expedite a congressional procedure that I think circumvents the regular order and could end up creating serious problems for beneficiaries in the form of cuts to the Social Security program.
And as you said, this speeds up what the process would normally look like, which means generally people might not be aware with what's happening with these bills, because normally when you're going to make changes to a Social Security-type program or any other program, yeah, these normally have to go through the usual committees. Those get hearings, chances for public comment. And as you bring up, this would significantly speed up that process, correct?
We're absolutely correct. The bill essentially, it circumvents that regular process or regular order, if you will. It fails to require committees of jurisdiction in the House. It would be the Ways and Means Committee, the Finance Committee, and the Senate to consider the legislation. Notably, the Trust Act will focus on solvency, completely overlooks the issue of adequacy of benefits. That's an important piece of any Social Security law change. And the Trust Act would have these committees consider only the funding, only the financial side, not the adequacy. And as you pointed out so accurately, it would deny interested parties, such as the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, an avenue to weigh in, to testify at hearings. We've seen this movie before, and fortunately, it has failed in the past. I think partially because the committees of jurisdiction believe that they should have control over this any legislation involving Social Security. And by the way, the Trust Act also picks up Medicare Part A, the hospital part, which is also funded by a trust fund, part of the payroll tax. So I see this basically as an effort to dodge cutting Social Security in a way that would allow members of Congress not to have very clear fingerprints on it and avoid the responsibility for the repercussions, which are considerable. Social Security beneficiaries are not living in the lap of luxury. The average benefit's about $1,400 a month. We should be focusing on ways to improve the program, improve benefits, have a more accurate cost of living adjustment, and extend the solvency of the program for a long time. That's not where I think this is headed.
Well, and you brought up the point that no one wants to cut Social Security. You look at any polling data, and a vast majority of poll respondents say, no, don't touch Social Security. And by speeding up this process, yeah, you can generally have politicians keep their fingerprints off this thing. And I think a good example is the letter you might have been referring to. I think this was signed by a Washington representative, Derek Kilmer, who signed on to this letter. Then all of a sudden, when he found out he was being primaried and his opponent was highlighting this, Kilmer started walking back his support of the Trust Act. So I think it's, yeah, case in point, every time you have a politician end up getting caught being or trying to cut Social Security, they normally run away from the issue.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. I followed some of that news in the last couple of days. Congressman Kilmer of Washington State.
Democrat, by the way, too.
A Democrat all of a sudden realized maybe this wasn't such a good idea and seemed to be backing off, saying he wasn't really supporting cutting Social Security. He thinks Social Security is a great program. He was more focused on the other programs that are funded by trust funds, such as the Highway Trust Fund. But I think if he didn't have a strong primary opponent, a progressive candidate, he might not have backtracked as he seems to have done. But I'm glad he's seen the light. I hope he takes his name off the support of the bill. I hope your Congressman Phillips, Democrat, also I understand Congressman Bergman, signed a letter supporting the legislation. He's not a co-sponsor. But what we see a little momentum on this because there is a bill, and it would, I think, lead to some serious cuts in the Social Security program without going through the process, as we just talked about, of holding hearings, developing legislation, having votes on a package under the regular rules of the House and the Senate. That might be a little more challenging to legislators, but that's what they signed up for. And that would allow the public an opportunity to express, as you pointed out, the overwhelming support of the American people for Social Security and for Medicare, and the overwhelming opposition to unpopular benefit cuts. And the reason I see a little momentum here is both Congressman Phillips and Congressman Bergman have signed a letter to the leadership of the House of Representatives requesting that this Trust Act be incorporated in any additional virus relief act. You know, there have been a couple of major bills that have been pushed through and signed into law, and there's a lot of talk about an additional piece of legislation to help our country get through this pandemic and the economic impact. And these two of the delegation from Minnesota want this rescue legislation to be incorporated. I think that would be a huge mistake. But it, obviously, there are some, and they're not alone, there are quite a few members, both Democrat and Republican, that signed this letter, and there wouldn't even be a vote, a separate vote on the Trust Act. It would be just put into another relief package, and we'd have to live with the consequences.
Well, that even goes a step beyond, yeah, just voting on the Trust Act, if they can just stick this into the next coronavirus relief package. And I want to highlight Dean Phillips because we've been talking about him. He, of course, is the 3rd District Representative in Minnesota, which represents a good portion of the West Metro, which is where our station is located and where many of our listeners live. I'm just very surprised he's on board with this because, while I know Dean Phillips definitely is not on the Bernie Sanders or the Elizabeth Warren side of the aisle, he's definitely not one of the more traditional moderate Democrats. I think for the most part, he's done a nice job staking out his different sides of the issues that I, for the most part, agree with. But on this, it's just very puzzling that he would be so forceful in support of this type of rescue committee and trust act that is being proposed right now, because this makes deep cuts to Social Security. And normally he comes down on the right side of issues. So, and as you brought up, he's seems very vocally in support of this, being that he signed on to this letter. What do you make of his support?
Well, you know, I'm puzzled as you are. The congressman has a good record on issues important to seniors, so I don't know if he didn't fully appreciate the impact of what this proposal does. You know, maybe he'll reconsider the way apparently the congressman from Washington, Congressman Kilmer, is now seems to be backtracking a little bit. But this is not consistent with some of the positions he's taken on programs like Social Security, like Medicare, that are to his seniors in his district and around the country.
So diving back into the legislation now, because I do want to get back into it. So once these rescue committees are created, they are going to make pretty dramatic cuts, because just to highlight this again, they're only looking at the financial aspect of this. They're not necessarily looking at, well, how do these benefit seniors? They're only looking at just ways to save money in the name of it being a financial emergency with what we've been seeing from COVID-19, correct?
Absolutely correct. And that is an additional a problem with the way the Trust Act legislation has been developed. As I said, you know, Social Security is a good program. It's been around for over 84 years, has lifted more people out of poverty than all other federal programs combined. It does have a long-term problem. The trustees of Social Security issue a report every spring. A few months ago, they told us the program we'll be able to pay full benefits without any changes for about 15 years. Then again, with no changes, it's going to run into problems and only be able to pay about 80% of benefits. I don't think any member of Congress would support a reduction of an average $1,400 a month Social Security benefit by 20%. So what I think we need to do is focus more on the benefit side, as well as bringing in enough revenue to make the program sound for the long term. As you mentioned, the congressman in Washington State, Congressman Kilmer, when he was confronted by some of his constituents, he pointed out he is also sponsoring legislation, H.R. 860, that does what I just talked about. It would improve the benefits of the program, have a more accurate and generous cost of living adjustment, raise the minimum benefit about $70 a month. Not a lot, but if you're living entirely or mostly on Social Security, $70 a month can make a difference, and bring in enough revenue to make sure the program is sound beyond the next 15 years. It's called the Social Security 2100 Act because it will fix the Social Security program so that benefits, full benefits, will be paid for the rest of this century. And the main way it does that is by requiring the wealthier wage earners to pay a little more into the program. Right now, there's a cap on wages subject to the Social Security tax, the FICA tax. Changes a little bit every year. This year, it's $137,700. After that, no more payroll tax. Why? We would support eliminating that cap, but politically, that's probably not all that realistic. What the legislation, H.R. 860, would do, keep the cap at what it is, and then start collecting payroll tax, again, at $450,000 in wages and above. That brings in enough revenue to solve all of the financial issues of the program for the rest of this century and improve the benefits. And, you know, we're looking, the trustees, as I mentioned, told us the program is able to pay full benefits for 15 years. That's before the virus hit. That's before we had 46 million people unemployed who obviously are not paying payroll tax. That's before people started claiming early that might not have, at 62, who might not have done so, but they don't have a job, so they're claiming early. So the date, that 2035 date, could be moved up a number of years. We don't know that yet. But this is not a time to be talking about cutting benefits. This is a time to shore up the program, make sure it's able to pay everybody for the rest of this century, and improve the benefit structure.
And that was part one of my conversation with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. That website is ncpssm.org. Coming up on the other side of the break in part two, we're going to talk about what could happen next with this possible legislation and even get into some presidential politics in terms of how Joe Biden views Social Security cuts, if he's in favor of those or not. That's on the way next on FYI Politics. Back to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Let's get to part two of my conversation with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We're talking about this possible bill that has the support of both Democrats and Republicans, including our own DFL representative in the 3rd District, Dean Phillips, for this bill called the Trust Act, which basically fast-tracks possible cuts to Social Security in the future. We're going to be talking about what could happen with this possible legislation up next and also get into some presidential politics. So here's part two of the interview with Max. So what's your read on what could be happening next with this legislation? Because what concerns me most that you brought up is that Congressman Dean Phillips and others are in support of this being part of the next coronavirus rescue relief package, where in theory, we could have politicians and representatives and senators who probably would not be in favor of making these types of reforms to Social Security end up voting for this bill anyways because they know that their constituents need financial assistance. So they would think, well, that's a trade-off we have to make. That's really concerning. Do you have any optimism that maybe we can, you know, get politicians more aware of this, get people more aware of this so we don't include this in the next coronavirus relief package?
Well, I'm doing that right now by being on your program. I did an interview at 11 o'clock this morning. I have another one in New Hampshire, which has also a House member that is supporting this. So that's, we're doing that to reach people that can contact their member of Congress. We also have written a letter to all members of Congress saying that incorporating this trust legislation in the next virus relief legislation would be a huge mistake, and urging them to object to doing that. And so I'm hoping the message will get through to the leadership in the Congress and to the rank and file members. That's the best the best way we can reach them is through forums like the one I'm on with you right now, and having members of their public, their constituents, contact them. So I hope anybody that's listening will contact Congressman Phillips and say, this is a mistake. You've done a lot of good things on programs affecting seniors, but this is a mistake, and you ought to reconsider your support.
Just a few more questions for you here, Max, but it is just so shocking to hear that Democrats, so many Democrats, are on board with this, because for Republicans, yeah, a lot of the times we think of them, we think of that stereotype, well, yeah, Republicans are for cutting these social safety net programs. But as you brought up, you were just naming some of the other shows, radio shows, podcasts you're going to be talking to, and it sounds like there are a number of Democrats, just besides Dean Phillips and the other Washington representative we were referring to, Derek Hilmer, who seem to be on board with this. So this bill does have very much bipartisan support.
Oh, yes. It's we are very concerned because it does have bipartisan support. And, you know, I think for some members, you know, I don't like to attribute motives to anybody, particularly members of Congress, of why they're doing what they're doing or supporting legislation that they're supporting. There's this ethos around that, well, with some members of Congress, well, we need to be bipartisan. We need to work with the other side. Yeah, that's true. But you don't need to work with the other side when the other side is wrong. As you pointed out, overwhelming support for these programs, Social Security and Medicare, all the polling I've seen for a number of years, upwards of 80%, Democrats, Republicans, independents, they support not only the programs as they exist, they support improving them. So, there is something to be said for being bipartisan. There is something to be said for trying to fix the program. But when you're going down a road that is so clearly anathema to the American people and to those who support so overwhelmingly Social Security, I think it's a dangerous road.
And final question for you here, Max, and this is more of a long-term outlook, because as we've brought up previous times, the Trump administration has been maybe not necessarily vocal, but open to the fact that they are open to cutting Social Security and other benefits, and that's something we often associate with Republicans. But the key to making sure we don't get these cuts are people paying attention. And what could potentially concern me is that, let's say Trump is defeated in November and we have Joe Biden in the White House. People might sit there and automatically think, well, I no longer have to pay any attention because we have a Democrat in the White House and Social Security is going to be protected as well as our other programs. That's obviously something we can't do. And what are you making out of what we've been hearing from candidate Biden in terms of protecting Social Security? He's definitely been saying the right things, but are you confident that if we do have a president-elect Biden, that he will keep those promises of not touching Social Security and Medicare and other
programs?
We'll
do whatever we can to make sure he keeps those promises. You know, he's been around for a long time. He's taken a lot of different positions on many things, including Social Security. And he was part of an administration that, when they were trying to reach a grand bargain, if you remember a few years ago, part of that grand bargain was agreeing to a change in the way COLAs are computed that would have lowered the cost of living adjustment. I don't know how, in 2010 and 11, the COLA was zero, so I don't know how you get lower than zero, but that was something that we opposed strongly, done by a Democratic administration. But I'll just finish with this. The day after President Obama was reelected, he invited a group of about 10 or 12 people to the White House to meet with him, his cabinet, and Vice President Biden. And I commended Vice President Biden because during the campaign, I heard him say time and again, I will not, as part of this administration, do anything that will reduce the Social Security program, reduce the Medicare program, and hurt seniors. So I look at that history, and I look at the fact that his website, if you look at his website on Social Security, it's indistinguishable from Bernie Sanders' website. I mean, his commitment is there. So I'm hoping that we'll never be oblivious to what is happening in the Congress and any White House with these programs. We'll be vigilant, but I feel a lot more comfortable than I do right now. President Trump, when he campaigned for the nomination, I watched all those Republican primary debates. There were 17 candidates. He's the only one that said time and again, I won't cut Social Security, I won't cut Medicare. And here we see, during the budgets that he has submitted, the Social Security disability budget has been proposed to be reduced. And look at what's been going on the last 4 or 5 months, when out of this administration we see efforts to cut, defer, delay the payroll tax. The payroll tax is what keeps the program alive. Without the payroll tax, Social Security would be strangled. And if we're looking at a solvency problem 15 years down the road, If you cut the payroll tax, as this administration has proposed, you're going to move that even closer to the present. Couple that with the fact that there's so many unemployed people not paying payroll tax. We face a serious problem that's much more imminent than would be otherwise. But to go back to answering your question, I will do whatever I can to make sure that a President Biden will live up to what he's been saying on the campaign, what he said in 2012, and I'm hoping that that is the way he governs.
And, of course, a big part of that will be people paying attention, and make sure you pay attention to these issues no matter who is in office. And, by the way, call Dean Phillips' office and tell him that this is a horrible idea with the Trust Act and setting up these rescue committees, which could lead to some substantial cuts for Social Security. And we've been speaking with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Their website is ncpssm.org, where you can follow along because, yeah, we haven't really heard a lot about the Trust Act in the news. So make sure you give them a follow, ncpssm.org. Hey, Max, really appreciate the time today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And one more time, that website for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is ncpssm.org. Well, that's just about all the time I got for my show today. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next on AM 950.